We could take the story on from when you're in Lyon, you're observing what's going on. You don't really want to talk very much about it. It was all rather horrible. But what happened after that?
Well, after
what were your orders while you were in Lyon? What were you supposed to be doing in Lyon?
Well, my mission was practically over by then, and I was more or less asked to observe what was going on. And after, I don't know how many days or weeks of that, I had really had enough. So I asked to be for a plane to pick me up and bring me back to England, which...
Could I just pick you up on one point?
Yeah.
I've read in a number of accounts of the resistance that once the liberation had taken place, de Gaulle made it fairly clear that he didn't want British officers or British-controlled officers to stay around.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you something about that.
Tell us about it.
Well, after I had left France, I was called back to, and I have a letter, I was ordered by command of General Eisenhower to return to France, to Paris, to be precise, and where I was awarded the Croix de Guerre with Palm, and which I received only in 47 anyway, because apparently it's done with the melted metal from the guns of Napoleon, but I doubt that very much. They ran out of guns or something. Anyway, I went back to Paris in November of 44, and I was staying with the George Vannies, and the purpose of my mission to Paris was nothing to do with the underground, but was to receive the Croix de Guerre from General de Gaulle. And I was there with, I think, 24, 25 British officers. And I forgot where, anyway, the Les Invalides, which is the sort of military or the Minister of National Defense of France. And de Gaulle pinned on each one of us one thing that he took off, and he left a ribbon of the Croix de Guerre. And he told us very politely, he gave us the accolade, you know, typical French kiss on both cheeks, I could have done without. And after telling us, he said, in very good English, he said, "Now, gentlemen, you have 24 hours to leave the soil of France," which we did. We knew damn well why, because most of us, the other British officers and myself, and a few Allied officers, had obviously backed the wrong people, the FTPF, which de Gaulle respected but didn't like. And he didn't want us, because he knew damn well that we had been very much in favor, because they were the most active of all and the most dependable. And it was in no uncertain terms that, and we all left France.
How did you feel about that at the time?
I thought it was very funny.
You weren't.
You had to have a sense of humor to be that kind of racket, I can assure you. I had been warned about that, and I don't remember whether it was by General Vannier or Marie d'Hautecloque, because Madame Vannier was related to Marshal Leclerc, who was renamed was Philippe d'Hautecloque, as you may or may not know. And his brother, Marshal Leclerc's brother, Henri d'Hautecloque, was at dinner at the George Vannier's, who lived on the Place Vendôme in those days. And I was staying with them in Paris. And I think it's Henri d'Hautecloque who had jokingly warned me. He said, "De Gaulle might throw you out of France." And that is exactly what happened 2 days after, when we were all decorated, mind you, very gallantly, but told to get out.
And you did. You went back to London.
Oh, you bet.
When you got back to London the first time, after you had left, you'd asked to be evacuated or taken back. You went to London. You were presumably given went through a debriefing process.
Oh, yeah, very long one. Yeah.
Can you tell us where that was, with whom it was? Presumably, this would be the first time you were
with
some of the top SOE people.
Sort of maison mère or house where we used to. Report to was at 54 Baker Street. I'm going to tell you something funny. I had been told it was anyway. So we had been taken to. I was living at the Grosvenor House. The Grosvenor House on Park Lane. And the next morning, anyway, after washing and then getting back in the proper uniform, or 2 days after anyway, I was asked to. My instructions were to report to the SOE headquarters. And I took a taxi and a cab, and I asked the cabbie, London cabbie, I said, 54 Baker Street. He said, sorry, sir, they've moved to Wampole Street now. I said, what? He said, yes, you must be one of them spies guy. I said, I'm not a spy, but anyway, okay. And he was right. Everybody in London knew where it was. But that the front of it at 54 Baker Street was a bank, the Barclays Bank, I think. And that was the front, but you told the teller, one of the tellers, anyway, why you were there, and then they took you to the back of the building where SOE headquarters were. It was, anyway. Which turned out to be a bit of a joke. And
this top secret headquarters. Yeah.
But on board the plane, coming back to England, which was, of all things, an American plane, an American bomber, there was an extraordinary woman called Christine, who was a Polish underground fighter who became a great hero in France. And she was on the same plane. I was 21. She must have been in her early 40s. I thought she was the most extraordinary. I had heard of, she was a legend in France. And I thought she was the most beautiful woman I've ever seen, whether it was the legend of Christine or her. And, so we talked a bit, and because in those days we didn't have jets. It was very slow flying. And I had all the way to Birmingham, where we landed, and taken to London by car. And when we got to Birmingham, I'll never forget that, I was dressed half as a British officer or French. I had French ranks and English ranks. And it was a bastard uniform, if you wish. We were taken to an officer's mess full of American officers, and we were several Allied officers there who had flown back and from Montbéliard. And they didn't know what the hell we were. And they were, why are you back from? And, I shouldn't say that this way, but anyway. We said, France. Oh, did you just go there? No, we've been there since April, or somewhere even before that. Why, you couldn't be there. We didn't land before the 6th of June. We said, well, I'm sorry, we were there. You try to explain to these guys. We didn't have a clue. And the guy who flew us, the pilot of this bomber, was a colonel, a lieutenant colonel. On the back of his jacket, he had bombs for each mission. I think he had two bombs. He had done two missions. And normally, a Royal Air Force pilot who doesn't carry bombs in his jacket to show how many missions probably has 50. He had two. That's unkind.
What happened when you got to SOE headquarters finally? Who did you meet?
Well, I forgot. There were a lot of people. You went from one person because there were different aspects.
What kind of things were they anxious to learn?
A general outline of what had happened during all that period. But they had, you see, they had a record of every transmission we had sent from France, and I had over 100. And about the equipment we were issued with or given, or that was dropped to us, some of it was. I never forget one item, for instance, they asked us how useful and reliable it was. It was the B2 set, the Morse key set that we used to transmit. It was not vocal, as you know. And I said, this is the most stupid set you ever invented because you carry it in the same. The Germans could detect that just by the suitcase. It was huge, you know. You didn't have those these gadgets by Sony, or Attaché. And they were huge damn sets, always packed in the same sort of suitcase that the Germans could look at and say, oh, he must be an agent from SOE. And they were bloody big things. And I said, don't give us sets like that. This is ridiculous. The Germans are fully aware what the set looks like and the bag it's in normally. Well, we can't help it. I said, you better help it because you lose more agents. And but as a rule, to come back, they were asking whether Allied support was good. It was extremely good, especially when I don't want to, I'll mention that after you. Especially when the RAF, Royal Air Force, was involved, it was always extremely dependable and reliable. And they were always on time. And since the British specialized in no bombing, which was far more risky, we always asked for the Royal Air Force, which is damn risky for the crew, the air crews, but it's very accurate. Because if you, in those days with the bombers they had, If you start bombing from 35,000 feet, your bombing was not always accurate. In other words, we missed the target, but you didn't miss any of the Frenchmen around it. If you can read beyond the lines, or
yes,
between
no,
the lines.
I know what you're saying. I know exactly what you're
and,
saying.
And, no, if it was, we always ask, and the messages came clear on the radio, on the BBC in French, to tell us how many planes were. They'd say, Alphonse will visit Maria tonight. That Alphonse in Maria was a special dropping zone. And they would say, Alphonse will visit Maria tonight 12 times, 12 planes. So we were there. And then they gave, there was another code for the time the planes would be there. And they were some time off because the Germans were there too in the air. But rarely, I mean, if they said like 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning, they were normally there. And sometimes they couldn't make it because they were intercepted by German aircraft. And unfortunately, many were shot down by ACAC.
These would be planes flying from
from either Africa or England. It was shorter from Africa. But, you know, you only had to cross the Mediterranean and go up their own. Whereas from England, it became and normally from Birmingham or places like that. It meant a long, long flight across England and then across the Channel and then across all of France. And the risk was, although, I mean, the risk was about the same on both sides. But we received supplies from both areas. I don't know this. But you asking me this, you remind me of so many things, you know, I don't know where to start.
Well, start with something that I reminded you of. What have I reminded you of?
Well, you reminded me of many things I would not want to insult anybody with. The questions that were asked at Wampole Street, not Baker Street, as the cab driver told me, the cabbie, he knew his stuff more than we did. And it covered every aspect of it, whether the cover stories were adequate, whether the papers we were given, the false papers were adequate, and they were pretty good. They had the best forgers of England doing their work at the very best. They must each one must have got the CVE, Companion of the Order of the British Empire for their work. Whether the supplies were adequate. And the only thing we complained with about was that there was not enough whiskey dropped. That was about all. But, and whether the escape routes, that we had some escape routes in case we had to either escape ourselves through the Pyrenees, through Spain, although fortunately I never tried it. And there were things like, these became more moral issues, if you wish, the use of cyanide. We used to carry cyanide, pellets or whatever they're called anyway. And I never asked, I never accepted any, but...
You had a choice.
You had a choice to accept. In case you're captured or before they torture you, you just swallow one and in 5 seconds you're gone. Perhaps. It depends on, I don't know. But I was never captured, so I don't know. And every possible aspect, because there's one thing you've got to give to the British intelligence, whether it's... I know MI5 is often criticized these days, and... But for my money, from the experience I have, it is still the most efficient intelligence service in the world. And not only that, it's because they back their agents, or people like me. I was not an agent, really. I was a liaison officer. But I suppose acting as an agent, I suppose, at times. They really back you up. They'll go to any extreme to support you. And this is, I can assure you, extremely important, because when you're alone in spots like France and later on in Malaya, in the jungle, you're very, very alone, and you're far from your mother, if you know what I mean.
It's certainly very difficult to find people who will make good agents because of this being alone. Now, a lot of people might have the ability to show bravery, courage, etc., but they can't do very well as agents because, as all books tell us, it's a very lonely and isolated existence, and some people crack under the strain.
Well, you're so much on your own. This is the whole point, is that it's not like when I was in Italy, I belonged to a regiment, you know, and even if I commanded 100 men, I was still part of an organization. But there, you are part of an organization. But in a totally different way, you're very much on your own. If you make, you can't afford to make mistakes. Nobody is going to bail you out as much as the war office backed us up. But you don't realize that at the time. I didn't really, because I was very young, and when you were 21, you're not, as I am now, 60 years old. I don't think you fully, you know it subconsciously that it's a bloody dangerous game, but you are more willing to accept it. You don't calculate all the risk. And it's got to be for young people. I hope that no young people will be involved in that, because I've become so anti-war. I'm not anti-forces, don't get me wrong, because I think we've got to protect what we have. The only way we have to protect, we have to have forces, ways to protect. I'm against aggressive forces of any kind. But protective forces, can you imagine if the Allies, that there was no NATO, no even the question of missiles today? It's highly debatable, admittingly. But if we disarm completely, what would happen? Russia would be on us within minutes. Eh? So where do you draw the line? I'm against. I saw Hiroshima after the war, and believe me, I don't want to see that anywhere. I couldn't believe it. I asked permission, and I was flown from Singapore to Hiroshima, and I saw it. And I saw it, several months after the thing took place. The inhuman aspect of it, it was in Japan. The people who got killed were old people, women, children. They're human. So, and even today, what you see in places like El Salvador and Honduras and Central America, and where do you stop? Or in the Middle East, in Lebanon,
It's always difficult to remember what you felt about things which happened a long time ago. But can you just attempt to tell us what you think you learned from the resistance experience?
I have to disagree with you on one point. Some of the incidents that took place at that time, even if it's 39 years ago, were so striking or shocking, or the impact was such that you cannot forget them. I'm not trying to dramatize, not at all. But even somebody, I met somebody the other day, a young man in his 20s, he's a young photographer, who reminded me physically so much of a chap who was in the underground with me, Ronald Shearn, who was a young British officer. I was shocked. And I went to speak to him. And he must have thought I was completely nuts. And I said, you remind me of somebody I knew. So much so, and everything, and not the fact that he reminded me of incidents that we lived together, Ronald Shearn and I, that came back to my mind like if I was looking at a film. No, some things you don't forget. You cannot forget them. Like, you may think it's absolutely ridiculous. I remember, as I'm talking to you now, in 1983, there on the 12th of April, I remember 39 years ago in 6 days exactly, when I was sitting in this Halifax bomber, exactly what I was thinking. I was watching the green light, which I knew damn well wouldn't come on for another hour. And there was a sergeant, a Royal Air Force sergeant, who came to ask me, and asked Wauchret how we were. I see it now there. Because I knew damn well what I was getting into.
What were you feeling right then?
Scared. But you control your fear. That's the whole point. But any man who tells you that he's not scared is a bloody liar. I was really it didn't show because I was in my family. You were taught from the day you were born to keep your feelings to yourself, not show them. But I can assure you, and Vaucheray and I and the operators didn't say a bloody word all the way. It took 4 hours from Algiers to where we jumped. And with one of the co-pilot of the bomber, an RAF chap, came to us and to ask us who we were. And fine. But it was not us. They offered us some, they had coffee in containers. We didn't have coffee or anything, nothing. And Vaucheray and I, that by that time had become quite close and we knew exactly what we were getting into. Not totally, but we had a pretty good idea. We just said the odd insignificant word. How do you feel? Are you? Fine. That was all, for 4 hours.
Did that fear evaporate somewhat after you'd landed?
Yes, because things happen so fast. You know. Don't forget, we were jumping at a very low height of 650 feet, which gives only the time to the chute to open, then you're on the ground. Otherwise, you don't want the German ACAC to get you, or German anti-aircraft guns to get you. And everything goes on. And the next 6 months, to give you an example, when I came out of France, when I jumped in France, I must have been about 160 pounds. And when I came out of France, I was 125 pounds. And I was apparently a bloody nervous wreck. I had become an introvert. I didn't talk to anybody. And I came to Canada where people were talking about the great misery they had gone to. In Europe, getting 50 pounds of beef a week, they got 49 pounds. It bore me to death. I thought they were ridiculous. I had seen misery, starving women, old men, children in France and in Italy before that. And people were complaining here that the ration had been cut from 50 pounds a week of beef to 49 pounds. I said, that's sad. And they only got a gallon of scotch a week in Europe. I don't know. I couldn't believe it, that people were so unaware, totally unaware of what had taken place all over Europe, in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in France, and in England, where it was no picnic either, I can assure you. And people here who had no reason to complain whatsoever, were complaining about the sugar ration, which has dropped by half a pound from 300 pounds a week to 299 pounds. It was ridiculous. And the worst part, it took me, when I came back finally after Asia, in 47, it took me until I met my wife to get. I love music. I'm a great admirer of Wagner, Beethoven, Brahms, and all this. The only thing I never said a word, and then played a lot of records. Because I couldn't communicate. I couldn't tell or make people feel, not to dramatize things, but to make them understand that. Because I was not French, I was damn lucky to be Canadian. Not to have lived that, or in Britain during the Blitz, or in the Netherlands, or anywhere in Germany, for that matter, because Germany took quite a beating, you know, don't kid yourself. And when I saw Berlin on my way back from Asia, you know, I couldn't believe it. I said, maybe this is Germany, but Berlin, Hamburg, Berlin, you know. And these were human beings, too. And what it did, although I remain under the advice of General Vanier and people like that, and General Bernacchi, I remained in the forces, but for a while I didn't know what the hell I'd do. It had taken all and the only reason why I continued my career in the forces, because I felt that there was a job to be done to guard or protect what we have, nothing else. And the life in the forces, I must say, proved to be highly rewarding for me. I've traveled all over the world after the war, every corner. I went back to the Far East. I went to Europe. I don't know how many times I've lived in Europe. And in the attaché jobs I had, I mean, it gave me a chance to meet all kinds of people, very interesting people, and either in London or in continental Europe. And So I really enjoyed my career, and I had the dream of any young officer, especially if his father had founded a regiment, to command my own regiment, which is an understandable ambition of a young officer. And, but after that, after I had some fantastic officers in man, over 1,000 and under me, and I enjoyed every moment of it. But not as a colonel barking orders, but a bit like a father, or although I was very young, I was one of the youngest, 37 in peacetime, to command a regiment, I was very young. But I enjoyed every moment of it. Because I felt I could do something, improved a lot of many of them, showed them perhaps contributing a little bit to their general education and betterment. I don't know, but